Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Welcome back, folks. You will recall Hurricane Helene in September as it moved up through the Florida panhandle, through Florida into North Carolina, and so doing it destroyed or damaged Baxter International's manufacturing facility there in Marion, North Carolina. That manufacturer was responsible for about 60% of the IV fluids used by American hospitals, equivalent to about 1.5 million bags daily. The problem was so severe that the Biden administration invoked the wartime powers of the Defense Production Act to speed the rebuilding of this factory of intravenous fluids back in mid-October. Recently, the Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Robert Califf says it turns out a huge part of his day is taken up on very basic supply chain issues across every commodity that they regulate. And Friday, they announced that three more IV fluids were in shortage, and it looked like that this shortage was going to continue to be a problem until around March of 2025 is what the expectations were, depending on what ultimately happens. And the importance of IV fluid use in medicine, I don't know if you can overstate it, and that's why we wanted to check that out with Dr. Peter W., Assistant Dean for Advanced Learning and Simulation at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Doc, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Newell. Happy to join you guys.
Happy New Year to you and your family. Haven't seen y'all in a while, but I hope things are going well, and thank you for joining us today. How serious is this issue?
This is a huge issue. It was big in October. People, stockpiled their fluids and then began conservation measures in each hospital and each facility, understanding that this was going to be a 6 month to a 1 year shortage.
And as we continue to move forward, there is talk, and I've read several articles about because of the expectation is that there's going to continue to be supply chain issues, that internal protocols within hospitals and the utilization of IV fluids might be subject to change. Is that true?
Well, it's absolutely true. But the use of IV fluids since October has changed dramatically across the entire country. And so people think it's
Can you give us some examples?
IV. Sure. Gladly. People think that it's just an IV, like you're dehydrated and here's your fluid. But IV fluids are used to mix medications and administer medications in all healthcare arenas. So not just hospitals, but also in clinics, as well as surgery centers. IV fluids are also used in formulating medicines within pharmacies that are infused, as well as in the operating room itself, where those IV fluids are given intravenously, but also used to irrigate areas as well. So the utilization of those IV fluids in the ORs would probably be the lion's share of the vast quantity amount that's used, which is hard to imagine, but people don't think of it in that manner. So it created, because of those supply chain shortages, it created workarounds and rationing of fluids. So instead of using a liter bag, you might use a 250cc bag. Instead of using an IV, you might encourage your patient, if they could, to drink fluids, which is vastly superior to receiving them IV.
So would one of the examples of treatment outside of the hospital where IV fluids would be used. If my memory serves me correct, it's utilized in like dialysis, right, and other things similar.
So fluids are used in dialysis. That's not going to change. That's life-sustaining care, right, when we're having a machine function as your kidney. We don't waste fluid there, and we don't conserve fluid there. There's little room there. But in the amount of fluid and the types of fluid we use within the operating room space, whether we're talking about bladder irrigation, whether we're talking about peritoneal irrigation or thoracic irrigation, large quantities, we're talking, you know, 30, 40, 50 liters in one procedure, that's been changed. That's been altered.
What is your sense, if you read kind of between the lines with what the FDA Commissioner Robert Califf was saying, it seems as though there's a whole lot in the medical supply sphere that they're having to manage from a supply chain issue, not only just IV fluids. Has that been y'all's experience?
So again, I want you to think of it not just the bag that's hanging that's going right into the vein, but that those fluids go to formulations of medications that have an impact across the entire healthcare sphere.
So when we think that
those fluids,
so when we think that there's one facility in one location that's responsible for producing about 60% of an IV fluid, I guess one would tend to wonder and scratch their head as to why we would allow something like that to happen if we want to control our own destiny here in the U.S., because I understand that the FDA has now approved the importation of IV fluids from other countries.
Well, but it's compounded, Newell, because I want to say a year ago, there was the similar scenario. It wasn't a hurricane. It was a natural disaster in Australia that led to a rationing of IV fluids in that country, which led to the European market providing IV fluids for that country in addition to the needs of their own. So when this happened in the U.S., you're really compounding the shortage internationally by the U.S. shortage.
Peter, I mean, you've practiced medicine a long time. You were in the emergency room a lot. I mean, I guess for doctors, you have to wonder the governance of this. Why wouldn't there be a heightened interest at the federal government level to make sure that we manage and massage our supply chain a lot more closely and in order to make sure that we don't have these anomalies that appear? I mean, the practice of medicine is hard enough. When they start asking you to ration medical supplies, I mean, how many more balls can you juggle?
Yeah, it makes it tough. But, you know, in working with our colleagues in pharmacy and working with our colleagues in nursing and working with our colleagues who operate the operating rooms and the surgery centers, you know, we rely on this interdisciplinary teamwork to address these kind of things, because this won't be the last supply chain shortage of a fluid or a needed medication, and we really do juggle those things on a daily basis. There are alerts of medication shortages all the time. We live in a world that has a short supply of blood, and we deal with blood shortages all the time, not just trauma centers, but in communities. And so that kind of staying more on top of it and communicating better across disciplines and then up to governing bodies is essential. And that's not going to change. If anything, that'll be more refined moving forward.
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this in one of the articles that I was reading, I think it was an orthopedic surgery center, they found themselves in a position where they had to cancel elective surgeries. And it was kind of like, wow. I mean, this is more severe than I ever thought.
Yeah. And again, when you talk about the utility of fluids, and then when we're doing joint therapy, surgical therapy, right, like a knee replacement, a shoulder replacement, you know, dozens of liters, you know, 20, 30, 40 liters of fluid can be used in a single operation for that. And so, you know, if you don't have it, you don't have it. And, you know, you have to be able to irrigate that space in order to reduce infection and to promote healing.
It's interesting, the fragility of the whole system, right? I mean, as someone from the outside looking in, when I read the first article, I was like, wow, wait, what? You know, you don't expect to hear that, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, Baxter built their plant in that area of Carolina with the assumption that this was a safe place. You know, this is once in a 100-year storm that hit them and wiped out both bridges leading to the plant. You know, I have friends that work for that company. You know, they've tried to help us to the degree they can't. And they want to get
interestingly,
back on board as soon as possible.
Interestingly, they're back online partially, but they can't get the product out of the manufacturing plant because, as you just pointed out, the two bridges haven't been restored. Last I heard, they may have been by now, but I was like, when you see the series of circumstances, it almost gets crazy. It's like reading a novel, like, you know, a fictional novel, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, can this get any crazier?
This couldn't happen here, right? But I mean,
right? Yeah.
You know, Newell, you and your readers lived through Katrina. Right.
Right.
And so you saw firsthand what supply chain looked like and what, you know, lapses in federal government oversight looks like, or dysfunction even of FEMA, what that looks like. You know, so it's tough. And so it means that having a robust team, boots on the ground for your institution, for your healthcare community, just how critically important that is. And, you know, LCMC and UMC have done a phenomenal job. And I would say that Ochsner has done the same. And it's a benefit to our community, right?
No,
it's a tremendous benefit to our community that they pivot quickly, that they look for opportunities, and they partner in a smart manner.
And that's the key. Those two healthcare systems have collaborated together on many occasions in the best interest of the community. And that's something that we should brag about.
Yeah, no, agreed, 100%. And, you know, we champion each other with the recent, you know, awful events on Bourbon Street, New Year's Eve. Ochsner was incredibly supportive to UMC and the Trauma Center. And so that's the world where we need to live in, where we mutually support each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us and backfilling the importance of this. And hopefully we can get this ship righted sooner rather than later, because, as you said, it's going to happen again. And who knows what looms on the horizon. Right.
Right. But you know, it's interesting. We're moving. We anticipate that within the next 2 to 3 months, this will be straight, and we'll be able to get Baxter up, functioning, running, and delivering the needed supplies on time, and then, you know, go back to business as usual.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Peter W., Assistant Dean for Advanced Learning and Simulation at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. We truly appreciate your time and your insight, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Newell. Bye.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Tax Line. We'll go to the talk lines when we return, so give us a shout. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Let's go back to the talk lines. Henry, you're up. What say you?
Well, I just wanted your opinion about something. I was just watching the news, and there were four or five Republicans criticizing Newsom for not having any water. But they've already said that the fire plugs are meant to have fire resistance. Well, that might be 4 or 5 houses, but not when 10,000 houses are burning at the same time. And in my neighborhood, there's a fire plug in front of my house. We have 4 blocks from the railroad track to the railroad track in Norco. And I think there's 3 plugs in the whole section. But if everybody was on fire, how would they do that? I mean, we take our water out of the river, but would there be enough pressure for every house here? Like they're saying, and then these people that criticize Newsom, they're not saying that the governor of Texas, Mexico, and Canada have sent multiple men to help with the fires. They don't say nothing about that. The governor of Texas is Republican, but he's sending help to California, but we don't hear that on the news. Now, what do you think about that?
I think part of the criticism is, and I don't know if you heard my monologue earlier, but I think there are 10 reservoir projects to be able to collect water and house water that's been caught up in the bureaucratic morass of environmental regulations in California since 2014. And only one just got their permit to proceed in 2024. And I think what a lot of folks are referring to is that there's no doubt everyone completely and totally understands the breadth and depth of the threat of wildfires. There's hardly a year go by that in California there's not a wildfire. So the questions that are being asked are, what is leadership doing relative to that? You're not going to be able to eliminate them, but the fact of the matter is how do you go about tackling that issue, remediate? What measures do you take that are necessary to ensure that folks are ultimately going to be safe? And there's been any number of very heated conversations between the federal government and state government along those lines. And because the environmental lobby in California is so strong, so powerful, that a lot of the elected leaders don't want to take them on and don't want to take a little bit more commonsensical approach as it relates to the infrastructure. I've heard that from firefighters that I've come across in California. We're hearing it from some retired right now that can speak openly and frankly about how they go about doing this and how many dollars are actually appropriated to the infrastructure. And when you think about in the Pacific Palisades, the mere size of that area, that there are 3 1-million-gallon tanks that provide water to the fire hydrant system there in Pacific Palisades. Well, one has to ask the question, if you know that you are susceptible to wildfires there, and you readily admit today that you have an infrastructure that you could only handle 2 fires in the Pacific Palisades area because of the shortage of water and the limitations there, what might one think about doing in order to improve that? It might be that we need more tanks, right? They can't use the ocean water because the salt water tends to corrode firefighting equipment. So the environmental quality restrictions in California don't necessarily allow you to pump salt water on ground because it has a tendency to contaminate the ground and kill some of the brush and otherwise. I get it. I mean, we have competing interests there, I understand. But I think these are legitimate questions. Is that enough? You know, and especially in light of wildfire warnings. I mean, you're living in a tinderbox. Little or no rain, significant drought conditions for lengthy periods of time. It's not like no one knew. You know, I mean, it's the same criticism that people had relative to us and how did we argue that with the maintenance of levees. You know, we went about getting real serious in the aftermath of Katrina, right? We had a collapse of a levee on the 17th Street Canal, where we found out that part of the situation was is that we were actually moving mud from one side of the sheet pile so that no vegetative debris would grow there that we had to cut because it was a pain in the neck to cut it. Well, we found out, you know, from an engineering standpoint, that wasn't such a good idea. And you don't see it going on anymore, do you? You know, so we were the subject of a lot of legitimate criticism, and we've had to self-reflect and change our attitude. We recognize some of the governance challenges that we had. We recognize some of the rules that we may had in place that didn't work very well. And we became more accommodating and more commonsensical in our approach as to how we were going to maintain the levees in our system. I mean, basically, that's all they've been asking them to do for decades with a lot of pushback and not much desire to change anything as the environmental lobby in California got stronger and stronger and stronger to the point where they have tried to influence environmental policy for the entire country. Thankfully, the remainder of the country has pushed back on that. I mean, when you think about it, in auto production, they have to produce automobiles just to meet the standards of California, separate and apart from the other 49 states. Is that crazy? That's absolutely crazy. Got a text here, says, Newell, the scooper aircraft are dropping ocean salt water onto fires. Yes, they are. They are, because they've relaxed those restrictions, and the salt doesn't affect the scooper aircraft like it does pumping equipment that firefighters deploy. And the reason that they're doing that is they have to fly too far away to get to a body of water, and they can make more trips, round trip, by just going right there, because most of his property is adjacent to the Pacific Ocean. Henry, thank you so much for calling. I hope that I answered your question. We're going to get to a break. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870. We'll go back to the talk lines. Give us a shout. This is Newell. So earlier we were talking about priorities, and obviously we know what's going on in L.A. County and the neighboring county relative to the wildfires. And California Democrats are celebrating that they've reached a $50 million agreement to shore up state and local legal defense funds against the incoming Trump administration just a week ahead of the president-elect's inauguration. Half of the money would be used to fight mass deportation plans. And the other half of the money would be to finance going to court for the State Department of Justice to fight the federal government in court and make sure that anything that they don't like, that they've got the funding in place and necessary to run to the courts and try and block the Trump agenda. And so just keep this in mind as it relates to this backdrop of the tug of war push-pull that's going on between the state of California and the federal government. It's kind of interesting how this is going to play out. And I'm very curious to see how this will play out in this political tug of war that's going on. They want to criticize those inside the Beltway for criticizing California. All the while, they are looking to pass legislation now that the Democrats have come to an agreement on the amount of money and how it's going to be spent. They are pushing it through the legislative process in California, and they anticipate that it will pass this week because it's important for them, symbolic message that they're trying to send, that they do this in advance of the inauguration on January 20th. And that's a priority for them right now. Meanwhile, hat in hand to the federal government in providing assistance in moving forward with fighting the wildfires there. Kind of interesting. You know, we've talked a lot about what Joe Biden has been doing as a lame duck, and not really a lot about where we stand on some of the major pieces of legislation that he's passed. There was an article in the Review, Las Vegas Review Journal, the other day that I came across, and I was reading that with several others, where these massive spending bills that were passed by the Biden administration, one, the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, where we provided $1 trillion on hundreds of projects. Most of them were within the green energy silos, right? But one that we've reported on before, and we thought it was worthy of a follow-up report again today, were these EV charging stations. So 3 years ago, with the passage of the infrastructure bill, they were going to set out to build these EV electric vehicle charging stations across the country. At the end of October, they built 19 in 9 different states. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon called this a vast administrative failure. Democrats are now stepping up and calling it for what it is. Remember, the election is behind us, right? Many state officials are blaming the legislation itself, which actually included a list of requirements regarding how and where the stations may be built, and better yet, who must build them. That's code for unions, right? Union operations are the ones that must build them, not going out to public bid and giving it to the lowest bidder. It's got to have all of these other requirements because they got to have a little ta-ta, right, for all of their political supporters. And as a result of this, it's caught up in the bureaucratic quagmire of the federal government. 19 charging stations in 9 states in a 3-year period of time. What's interesting is that we learn also that the broadband project, right, that was to bring internet service to the rural areas of this country, that 3 years after its creation, the program has dispersed no money and supplied broadband to 0 households. The rules, again, are very similar to what you're seeing in the EV world, require states accepting the money to make sure that providers plan for climate change, that they reach out to unionized workforces and hire locally. And one provision is vague, requires low-cost options and fast connections for middle-class families at reasonable prices. What does that mean? They can't even figure out how to define that moving forward to see how this is going to ultimately play out. I mean, it would seem to me that you, and one of the recommendations in this article and many others is that, well, why don't you just let the private sector figure this out, right? But no, again, the ta-ta has to be there, present for all of these special interest groups to make sure everybody gets a little taste. And meanwhile, which I don't know why we didn't expect this to happen, nobody's tasting anything at all because they can't get through the process because of all the requirements there that many of which are going to run violative of public bid laws in respective states and things of that nature, and they're having to get creative and exotic as to how they're going to actually end up distributing these dollars in order to accomplish much of anything. The other day that we find out that the little public relations tour of Jennifer Granholm relative to driving across a significant piece of geography in an electric vehicle, that they violated all kinds of federal rules and regulations as it relates to housing and reimbursement for expenses. And that debacle ended up costing you, the taxpayer, tens of thousands of dollars for what? Oppressor, right? And it was a debacle. It didn't even work. And in many cases, they had to make things up in order to make it look like that they actually accomplished something at all. I mean, that's how bad this continues to be, where they're actually doubling down on a lot of these things that the public obviously felt very strongly about and said, no, no more. We don't want that. That's not what we want. And you're seeing it. There's no better example of it than there is relative to immigration. Why in the world that Alejandro Mayorkas would do what he's done relative to TPS in the last couple of days, granting that status to over 1 million individuals, some of who have enjoyed that status, temporary protection status, for in excess of 24 years. And why we would think that's a good idea, I have no idea, but it just continues to come each and every day. January 20th, in my view, can't come fast enough. Because what this administration has decided to do is all of the things that they could never pass legislatively, they're just throwing it out there in executive orders and doing what they and pushing it. It doesn't matter, because if they end up having to go to court, it's going to be the administration basically suing the administration. And then you're going to have all the special interest groups that are going to come in and try and create delays. Because mind you, Donald Trump serves one term. That's it. So every day delayed is a success for Democrats, because they know one term. And that makes it a lot easier to just muck it up and try and delay it as long as possible. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Chula's talk and text line. Stay with us. So last Thursday, the Senate voted to begin debate on the Laken-Riley Act. It was a vote of 84-9. 8 Democrats and 1 independent voted in opposition. The debate occurred 2 days after the House of Representatives voted to pass that bill. And the Senate version of the Laken-Riley Act is, for all intents and purposes, identical to the House version. Specifically, the bill requires the detention of inadmissible aliens for theft-related crimes. It requires the Department of Homeland Security Secretary to issue detainers for those aliens and transfer from local law enforcement into ICE's custody, and grants state officials with legal standing to sue the federal government due to harm inflicted on their states or citizens from the failure to enforce our immigration laws, including failing to detain and remove illegal aliens and illegally granting parole. So it's going to be interesting to see what the ultimate vote is going to be here. There's a lot of momentum that's been created around this bill. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer refused to bring the legislation to the Senate floor in the last session. With a new Congress and new majorities, the Laken-Riley Act was reintroduced the first week of January, and obviously Congress acted very quickly, with the House passing it on a 264-159 vote, with 48 Democrats joining in support on the House side, 11 more than when the bill first passed in the House. So It will be interesting to see. Obviously, still can't get bipartisanship. This is one of the first immigration bills that has passed the House without all kinds of other provisions making illegals legal in some aspect or having some other things tied to this bill that in many respects were contrary to the best interests of this country. And always kind of mucking it up with not increasing enforcement on the border, but doing a lot to try and allow more people to legalize themselves after they came to the country illegally. So we'll see where this goes. So the Senate is going to take it up and vote on it. And it may be the first time that we've passed something as it relates to immigration in a big way. All right, we'll be right back after the break. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. When we come back after the top of the hour news break, we will visit with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about the Federal Reserve new direction, California wildfires, and the implications to insurance as a result of that. The Chinese economy struggles, and a Chinese economist is silence. China's trade surplus reaches a record of nearly $1 trillion, and we'll talk about a number of other issues as well when we return with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Stay with us.